Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Just finished leading a 10-day retreat on Sunday, a couple of days ago, here at the retreat center, Dharmavati. Shortly before that in Thailand, I was co-leading another 10-day retreat with Ajahn Kongrit, Ajahn Piyasilo in northern Thailand. And before that, I was leading a couple of retreats in India, in Himachal Pradesh at the Deer Park Institute, and then in Delhi. And it's over these last few months, so since sort of April, May, June, through this time, whether it's in Thailand or India or England, it seems that there are some themes or some issues that are, I say, universal. Also, people are coming from many different countries to join in with these retreats and engage in meditation. And so over and over and over again, one of the biggest issues or concerns or areas of work is that of conceptual thought, the thinking mind, and the way that the thinking mind has an impact on our lives. And I thought that might be a good theme to reflect upon for this evening. It has such a powerful and say continual, consistent influence on our minds as individuals and as a culture. And so I feel this is an area that benefits from a lot of attention. How does thinking work? How do we relate to thought? What's our attitude towards thinking, and what can be done about that? How can that world of thought be worked with? It's really striking if you talk to people and listen to the news, or just having conversations with friends and visitors to the monastery, how prevalent the issues of anxiety and depression, mental distress of various different kinds are in society, not just in the adult population, but amongst younger people, school children. Incredible numbers of people suffering from mental distress, very negative self-image, people attempting suicide, people needing psychiatric help, or at least therapeutic help, counseling, at a very, very young age. And this is all around the world. It's not just here in Britain, in the West, it's in the English-speaking countries by any means. It's the same in India, same in Thailand, and people all around the world. Yeah. Recount how this is. These are similar issues, similar concerns in society, all around the planet. So I feel this is one of the reasons why it needs a lot of attention, because it affects our lives, not just us as individuals, but the people that we care about, the people in our families, the people that we live with, the people in the world around us. So to me, the major source of that kind of mental distress, depression, anxiety, self-hatred, self-harming, and so forth, so much of it is fueled by the thinking mind, our thoughts, and the way our thoughts move, the judgments that the mind makes, and how we believe in those judgments. And so that I feel one of the great blessings of Buddhist meditation and Buddhist psychology is how it can bring a perspective on the thinking mind and can really provide some tools for us as individuals and to offer to others that can help to change the attitude that we have towards thinking and to steer our thoughts in a different way and to in a sense use thought for the purposes that it's most helpful for in our lives, because it's not just the fact that thought is an oppressive, it's not like thought is necessarily an oppressive demon. It's not like our thinking mind is some kind of terrible brain disease, but thought can be an incredibly powerful and helpful tool. It's also one of humanity's greatest gifts and blessings. It's one of the extraordinarily powerful aspects of our life. But it seems that when it gets out of control, it's lost its boundaries, it's got out of balance, then it becomes a source of great suffering and difficulty rather than a source of blessing and benefit. But in terms of attitude towards thinking, so because I've been talking a lot about this over the last few months, I realize something in me blames people like Plato and Socrates, Aristotle, the Greek philosophers who, in the ways that they talked about thought, and this is the sort of foundation of the European attitude towards thinking, is that from the era of the Greek philosophers, thought was taken to be an ultimate reality, that the thought is the most sort of pure representation of truth. And so thought is sort of exalted or praised, so that we, even though you might think, I don't even know who Aristotle was, or oh, it's pronounced Socrates, I thought it was Socrates. Maybe it's something very remote or strange, or Plato, who's Plato? But even if we don't know the names, or those aren't familiar, we haven't read any of their works, still the attitudes and the things that they said and the way they saw the world filters down into our societies and affects the way that we see the world, I would suggest. So that what we have is that we tend to view our thoughts as being absolutely true, always meaningful, and who and what we are. They are ours. They are owned by us. They represent exactly what we are. So that we take them to be true, we take them to be meaningful, and we take them to be self, I would suggest. At least generally that's how it's held. So I feel one of the most helpful things then with respect to thought is to, first of all, change the attitude, to sort of ramp it down a bit from thought being an ultimate reality to, say, looking at it from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, where thought is a sense object. The eye perceives light, the ears perceive sound, the nose perceives odors, the tongue perceives flavors, the body perceives physical sensations, and the mind perceives thought. So that thought is a sense object, like we see form or color with the eye, and it's a sense object. We might have some sort of special meaning or value to it, or it might not. It might just be a something that is incidental. Like I can look at the color of the tiles, these limestone tiles of the temple floor. I can look at the color of the oak beams, and it's a sort of, the oak is a pale brown. The tiles are a sort of creamy colored gray. I don't have to make anything of that. It's just a color. It doesn't have any meaning. It doesn't have any particular value. It's a color. It's just a form in nature. It doesn't have to have any special meaning or value. The sounds of the airplanes flying overhead to Luton Airport, it's just the sound of a plane's engine. It doesn't have a special meaning or value. It's just a sound. Or the birds, the blackbirds, as they make their evening calls and settle down for the night, it's a blackbird evening song. That's all. We don't have to make anything out of it. The the changing of attitude towards thought then, from being something that's intrinsically meaningful and true, to just another sense object, like hearing the sound of a plane or a bird, seeing a color of a tile or a carpet or a beam, seeing the color of the sky or the changing light of the evening. It's just that. The mind doesn't have to make anything of it. It doesn't have to see it as meaningful. It doesn't have to see it as anything particularly significant. We can change the attitude towards it. So I feel this is... it takes a bit of work to do that, because when we think, the passage of thoughts through our minds, we take it automatically to be something that is true. Like we say, this is good, or this is bad, or that's beautiful, or that's ugly, or this is the way it should be, or this is the way it shouldn't be. Like I was noticing the incense burner on the shrine, it's not quite centrally placed this evening. When somebody tidied the shrine, they didn't put the incense burner back in exactly the central place. So I can look at that and I say it's in the wrong place. It shouldn't be there. But it is exactly where it is. So any sense of wrongness is coming from the mind that sees it. And until I said that, probably nobody else in the temple had noticed that. Now you're looking at it and think, oh, right, that's true. Or I can't really see that from where I'm sitting. Or I was in charge of the shrine. I put it there. Ooh, what will they think of me? Yeah, I'm the bad placer of the incense burner. I'll be fired from my job. People will scold me. This is what the mind adds. It creates a judgment and then takes it to be something that's absolute. The teachings of the Buddha and then in our current times, Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Sumedho, they point so often to this way that the mind creates judgments and believes them, and how the mind says, it should be this way, it shouldn't be this way, this is right, this is wrong, this is beautiful, this is ugly, I approve, I don't approve. And it takes those judgments to be absolutely true and meaningful. When I first went to Thailand and went to visit Wat Pa Phong for the first time, in the early 1978, I was really struck by this strange kind of concrete network thing over the gateway to the monastery. And I was going over with Ajahn Prabhakara, who was the abbot of Wat Pa Nanachat, the international monastery. She's just a few miles away. And I said, what's that strange kind of concrete network thing over the gateway? And he said, oh, that's a kind of... hill or a cave that Ajahn Chah was building, so that when it's under construction, and so it's got all these concrete beams, and it's in this strange kind of lattice work shape. So he's going to make it into a cave, so that when any vehicles approach Wat Pa Phong, it'll be like going through this gateway into a cave. Oh, that's interesting. So that was my first week, and then of course 6 months later, it's still there. 2 years later, it's still there. 10 years later, it's still there. Nothing's been added to it. It's still this strange kind of frameworky thing. 15 years later, it's knocked down. Decided not to build it. So what was it? Was it a kind of a cave in the making? Or was it a failed project? Was it a bright idea of Lumpur Chars that other people didn't approve of? You could add anything to it that you liked. Yeah, you could read into it all sorts of things, but it was just that. it was a set of material forms arranged in a particular network, like a sort of a bird's nest with a kind of square space in the center, and the mind could make of it whatever it wanted to. But it was a really good example to see the way that the mind creates the world. It creates, well, that was a waste of time and money, or, well, it could have been a wonderful thing, or, it came into being, it was what it was, and then it disappeared. It was anicca. So in a thousand different ways, every single day, our minds create these kind of judgments. this is good, this is a failure, this is success, this is a brilliant idea, this is a terrible idea. Yeah. This is beautiful, this is ugly, this is delicious, this is awful. This is a beautiful smell, this is a terrible smell. And if we develop the mindfulness and wisdom to notice those judgments, then we can, in a sense, ramp it down to see that that's the mind making a judgment. Who says that's true? What the mind reckons this is right? Then who says? Yeah, maybe that the incense burner was precisely placed. The person arranging the shrine measured exactly just the perfect distance off the center that it should be to create the sort of interesting resonance of wrongness, together with the symmetry of the shrine. They spent hours working out exactly the right degree of wrongness. Probably not. But you never know. It's like Marcel Duchamp, the famous non-artist, the Dada artist. He spent years and years, did 20,000 pages of calculations for this particular artwork known as the Large Glass. Which is this, I won't go into details about it, but it had all sorts of different markings and images and things in it. And then on the way to it being installed in this art gallery, a couple of the art gallery helpers dropped it. And I said, oh no, this is, like, he spent like years and years calculating where to put all the lines and the spirals and the images and the smoky areas and exactly the right number of matches to burn to create the smoky patches on the glass. And now we've dropped it, we've broken it. So they were absolutely terrified of what Marcel Duchamp would say when he saw this crack right across the large glass. And to their surprise, when he saw it, he said, parfait. It's perfect. Yes. That's just what it needed, the big crack. So I think he was probably looking on the bright side. But also, maybe that was exactly what he was being also true to the spirit of the artwork. So if we make that an exercise during the course of a day, just to notice how many times the mind makes those kind of judgments. If you have a little kind of counter, you could actually enumerate how many judgments the mind makes during the day. We don't need a counter, but if you just make a mental note, I find it's really shocking, amazing. The amount of times the mind says, I approve, I don't approve, this is good, that's bad, it should be this way, it shouldn't be this way, this is a good person, this is a bad person, this person is doing it right, they're doing it wrong, I admire this person, I don't admire that person, this one's inspiring, this one is irritating, this one is intimidating, this one is encouraging. It's amazing how much judging the mind does, and then also how absolute the mind takes each of those judgments to be. When we say, oh, that's beautiful, it is beautiful according to those perceptions. So to work with conceptual thought, I find one of the most helpful things is to challenge those judgments, to notice the mind judging and describing something as right or wrong, it should be there, it shouldn't be there, and to question that. Again, this very simple and direct practice that Lumpur Cha would encourage and to develop that questioning attitude is whenever the mind makes a judgment, this is beautiful, is that so? This is awful, it shouldn't be that way, is that so? Yes, this is exactly what I wanted, is that so? This is a disaster, this is exactly what I didn't want, is that so? And then even more simply, which I like to encourage, it's a trimmed down version, is just, so, this is awful, so, this is wonderful, so, yes, this is exactly right, so, at last I finally got things the way I wanted, so. And if we apply that simple reflection consistently, steadily, to all of the judgments that the mind makes during the course of a day, it's amazing how much more space there is in our world, how much there's an easing of the heart. We can really imprison the heart by all the rights and wrongs, the goods and bads, the beauty and uglinesses that we create. It's like a being in a straitjacket, sort of buckled into a tight, confining a straitjacket of opinion and judgment and view. And so by, say, developing that quality of questioning to, say, bring that attitude of questioning, of developing the anicca sanya, the realization, the recognition of uncertainty, that frees the heart to at least some small degree. And when the mind makes a judgment, then it's recognizing, oh, well, that's one perspective. You know, from one point of view, there's a wrongness there. From another point of view, it's right. One point of view, that smells beautiful. From another point of view, that smells awful. You know, from one point of view, that tastes delicious. Another point of view, it tastes awful. It's just a particular point of view. And so then there's a freedom in the heart that comes from that recognition, just being able to see that any kind of statement that the mind makes, right or wrong, beautiful, ugly, good, bad, that there's a relativity to that. Obviously, we have the precepts that the Buddha also established to guide our behavior in terms of speaking honestly, speaking in a way that is kindly and respectful, to respect the lives and property of other beings, to behave respectfully in terms of relationships to other people, and to refrain from intoxicants and so forth. There's the structure of the precepts gives us guidelines for the choices to make that will lead to happiness and well-being rather than to confusion and conflict. So within the boundaries of the precepts, or informed by the precepts, still this way of reflecting upon our thoughts, our judgments, I feel goes a long way to, say, freeing the heart from that the prisons that are created by conceptual thought. And so often those feelings of anxiety and depression are coming from the mind believing in its creations, like this is a problem, I need to worry about this, what's going to happen if I'm an awful person, nobody loves me, I've done something terrible, I can't be forgiven, they hate me, I'm not good enough, I'm not clever enough, I'm not beautiful enough, I'm not competent enough, they don't like me, they think I'm a fool, they think I'm ugly. And even saying those words, you can probably feel your heart sort of... Even though it's just hearing the words, something in us shrivels, sort of tightens up. And, ooh. Even hearing the word, even just the subject being raised, it's painful to hear. So when we take those judgments to be true, and nowadays with social media, the amount of judgments that we're not just creating for ourselves, but others are creating for us, that others are judging our own the way we present ourselves to the world, others are vigorously judging us as well, then believing all those judgments, taking them all to be true, then it creates this extraordinary tension and stressing in the heart. It creates a prison, a kind of psychological prison, a mental prison. So this kind of practice, noticing the judgments that the mind makes, challenging them, that's a way of kind of loosening those prison bars and freeing the heart from that. Another of the aspects about thinking is how we assume that all our thought is meaningful, and one of the ways that I like to encourage us to change the attitude towards thinking is, like, say, living here at Amravati, we have a lot of animals, like a lot of birds and squirrels and creatures that run around, and particularly the birds, so they sing a lot, they make a lot of sound, but probably none of us can understand what the birds are saying. Maybe there's one or two ornithologists, you know, people who are studiers of bird language who can understand some of what the bird songs are, but most of us can't. It's just the sound of the birds that they're making. And so that as we hear our thoughts going on, remembering, planning, imagining, fantasizing, to shift the attention from those thoughts having any kind of meaning, even if they're not being judgmental, just the content of them. That if we look at the flow of thought through our minds, that's roughly speaking, I say 95% is just the replaying conversations, things that we've read, things that we've seen, articles from the news that we might have read, memories from the past, imagining and recollecting. And 95% is basically meaningless, and it's just sort of internal chatter and replaying perceptions from the past and imagining a future that hasn't happened. Maybe about 5% is of meaningful content. So just to relate to the flow of our thoughts is just the chattering of the birds. Just like it's just the bird song of the mind. Or another way I like to speak about it is if you can, it's in the summertime, you can hear a radio playing in the neighbor's garden, or you're sitting in a building and you hear the radio from the, or television from the next room or from across the way. And you didn't choose the station. You're not interested in the program. But it's there. You can hear the sound of it. You can hear the words. You can discern some kind of meaning. But the mind is like it's you didn't choose it. You're not interested. But it's there. It's kind of doing its thing. It's giving its voice, and you don't have to hate it. You don't have to make it shut up. You don't have to have an opinion about it. You don't have to be paying attention to it. It's just the sort of burble, 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 rhubarb, 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 as they say. And that our own thoughts we can relate to in the same way, just like the neighbor's radio or the a TV playing in an airport departure lounge, or if you're a monastic and visiting your family's home, the TV going on in the corner that you're not particularly paying attention to, that you can hear the voices, you know what the words mean, but you don't have to give it value or meaning. And so in the same way, we can relate to our thoughts in this fashion, and to learn how to just know, well, that's just a sound in the mind. It doesn't have to have any particular special value or meaning. It's just a sound, like the shape of the pillar or the color of the oak or the color of the tiles. It's just that. It's just that color, that shape. It's no special thing. So that I find just having the presence of mind to change the attitude towards our thoughts. That it's just the TV in the corner. It's just the neighbor's radio. It's just the birds in the trees. That's all. And using that power of reflection, wise reflection, it changes the framework for the flow of thoughts as they're being experienced. Because the tendency is to go into the story that they're telling and the future that they're planning, or the past that they're replaying, or the opinion that they have about this person or that person, and taking it to be meaningful. But it doesn't have to be meaningful. We give meaning to things, but they don't intrinsically have a meaning. Like you say, what does the color of these tiles mean? What does the evening light mean? Meaning doesn't apply. It doesn't mean anything. It just is what it is. Like the nest of concrete beams over the gateway at Wapapong. It didn't mean anything. It's just that. That's all. So again, if we have the presence of mind, it takes a kind of mindfulness and a readiness to say, oh, look, I'm getting lost in that TV program. I'm getting involved in the sound of that radio. I'm getting involved in this string of thoughts. But I don't have to. It doesn't have to be that way. So catching it, seeing the mind being drawn in, and then making a conscious choice to turn the attention away. It doesn't have to be based on negativity or fear or repression or aversion. It's just choosing to not attend. And again, if we train the mind to do this, there's a lot more space in our days, a lot more space in our world. an exercise that that Lumpo Sumedho used to teach that I like to encourage people to use, and I've used a lot myself and talk about quite often in this respect, is to actually make an exercise of learning how to think consciously. So you take a simple, very benign statement like, today is Tuesday. It's not personal, it's not emotionally loaded, unless you're really, you get excited about the food offerings of the Tuesday group. Oh, it's Tuesday. So maybe Tuesday is not a good day to choose. But if you're particularly attached to the Tuesday group's food offerings. But take something that is benign. It's very simple, like, you know, today is Thursday. It's not personal, it's not emotionally loaded, but it's a conceptual thought. And to make an exercise of that, so that you notice when the mind is, when you're sitting in meditation, the mind is as quiet as possible, then you deliberately think that thought. Something very, very simple. Today is Thursday. This year is 2019. This year is 2019. So you notice the space before, you notice the thought when it's present, you notice the space after. So in that, you're consciously developing the recognition of thought just as a sense object, just like a sensation in the body or a sound that is being heard or a visual form. It's just, there's a thought, it's a concept. This is 2019. And this is Tuesday, this is Thursday. That there is that concept in the mind, but there's no sense of that being something that has to fill the attention or something that's important or special. It's just a thought. So if you use that as a way of training the mind to know a thought and not get lost in it, to just know, oh, it's just a thought, that's all. Then you do that as an exercise. You learn, you train yourself to do that, and it takes. It can be pretty boring. Sit there. This year is 2019. But if you take the trouble to carry that out as an exercise, like any kind of exercise, it can be boring. If just to strengthen the muscles or to just improve your lungs. The exercising on its own can be boring, but the effect of the exercise is really useful. So in this way, by taking something very mundane, very non-personal, unemotionally charged, this year is 2019, today is Tuesday, today is Thursday, then when you have the thoughts that are more emotionally charged, and you can also practice with this, that I am a bad person, right? I am a good person. Yeah, I am a success. Or I'm a failure. Things that are more personal, more emotionally charged. Then again, you can work with it in the same way. Can you see the space before, the space around, the space within those thoughts? Can you see the transparency of those thought forms? I'm an awful person. I'm a good person. I'm a failure. I'm a success. Everybody loves me. Nobody loves me. The development of that perspective is a very powerful tool. The more that we can see that every thought intrinsically has space around it, it doesn't fill the mind, and that the habit of absorbing into a thought, believing in it, taking it to be true, taking it to be meaningful, taking it to be self, it's just a habit of the mind. It's just the conditioning of the mind. And using this kind of exercise, then even very personal thoughts or things that are like a really strong issue that it's our responsibility to make a choice about, even then we can develop that sense of the space before, the space after, the space around, the space within, even emotionally charged and very personal thoughts that have got a lot of emotional loading and thoughts, decisions that we need to make that are going to affect the lives of ourselves and other people. Still, they can be held in that same kind of spacious and clear perspective. So another way of working with thought, rather than deflating it in this way or seeing the empty nature of it, a method that Lumpur Sumato would often encourage is to go the opposite direction, to inflate. And I talk about this a lot because I found it extremely helpful. I do this a lot myself in my own practice, and I found it very, very potent over the years. And just talking with someone today, they were describing how many years ago, when they were on a retreat with Lumpur Sumato back in the 80s, and he was talking with Lumpur, and Lumpur said, "So, do you have any particular strong issues in your practice? What things do you have that are especially difficult to work with?" And this person said, "Well, I'm a worrier. I worry a lot. I'm really anxious." And so Lumpur, to his surprise, said, "Okay, so for the rest of this retreat, worry as much as possible. Really crank it up. So make yourself worry about everything. Even things that you wouldn't normally worry about, take hold of them and really make it a problem. Just everything that you can see, just make really worry to the maximum degree possible about it." So this person had enough faith in Lumpur to say, "Oh, even though it was a kind of a strange idea, really, I want it to diminish. I don't want to make it stronger." But Lumpur said, no, this is a particular approach. But take every single thing that you can see and you perceive it, and really crank it up. Make yourself worry about it as much as possible, and see what happens." And so he said, I had faith in Lumpur, and I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And so I did that for the rest of that retreat. And by the end of the retreat, and ever since, I've never been able to worry about things in the same way. It just broke the habit, because when you inflate it in that way, when you make yourself follow that particular track, it exhausts it. It somehow it overfeeds it, and it loses its strength. That you are consciously trying to worry about everything, and you find yourself laughing at it. It's like, well, I'm worried about will there be any electricity to run the toasters tomorrow morning? Will there be toast for breakfast? This is a problem. This is a big problem. Will there be toast for breakfast? I mean, what are we going to do if there isn't toast for breakfast? And you say, you get halfway through the thought, and then you just crack up laughing, because it's like, well, you do something else. And so I found that was very striking. And I said, well, I've been doing that and encouraging that same kind of approach for years and years. And I was reminded when I was in Thailand with Lumpur Cha, and somebody was asking about anger. They said, "Lumpur, I've got a big problem with anger. I'm just so reactive and angry all the time." And he said, "Okay, well," and exactly the same kind of approach. So instead of doing mindfulness of breathing, do mindfulness of anger. So as you normally would do, when you sit down to meditate, rather than focusing on your breath, make yourself angry. Think about something that brings up anger. Think of the monk that you're most annoyed with, and create the angry feeling, and then sustain that anger for an hour. So you have to keep it alive. Let's start with mindfulness of breathing. As soon as your mind wanders off the breath, you would bring it back. So as soon as your mind stops being angry, let go of the non-anger, come back to being angry. Keep the anger going, and do that for an hour. And so Lumpur, my Thai was very, very poor, but I could follow enough. And then there was one or two other Western monks that could translate that were there. So, and I said, "Really? Is that what he's saying?" Yeah. But he was absolutely sincere. And he says, "Okay, do that and see what happens after staying angry for an hour. See what the effect is." So I don't know how it was for that other monk with the anger issue, but I tried it myself. It's almost impossible. It's far harder than mindfulness of breathing. It's really, really, really difficult. And by the time I got to the end of the hour, there's absolutely no way you can feel averse towards anything. Because the entire negativity reflex is just gone. It's exhausted. So, and I thought, oh, that's That's why he taught that. So this kind of way of inflating the mind's reactions, but it takes a certain amount of steadiness of attention. If it's just sort of within the jumble of thoughts and emotions, it'll just make you more upset, and more angry, reactive, jealous, lustful, fearful, and so forth. So it needs to be carried out in quite a focused way, in quite a deliberate way. But if you do, then this is a very, very potent practice. So that when, again, it's a way of working with judgment. So that if you find an emotional reaction, you're annoyed with someone, like, oh, I can't believe she did that again. Why did she do that? Well, you know, this person's just a blight on my life. If she was just gone, life would be great. I'm not reading anybody's mind. But this is how we can think. Like, oh, that Ajahn is so annoying. Why is he always like that? If he could just die, that would be great. You know, it's not the sort of thing that Buddhist monastics are supposed to think, but it does come to mind sometimes. You know, just that sort of wave of irritation, or if I could just have such and such, if I could just be somewhere else, that would be great. If I didn't have to sort of be here, if only I could be at that other place, the other monastery where it's perfect. There's a friend of ours in the States, the head of a Zen monastery, and so she gives whole Dhamma talks about the other monastery where everything is perfect. The other monastery never gets named, but yeah, that monastery where everything is perfect. To catch that and see how the mind is making a judgment, and then to notice that, and then to replay that, to in a sense like taking a snapshot and then bringing it back into focus and looking at it closely, so that you hear your mind making that kind of a judgment. Yeah. You know, why is he like that? I wish he would just go away or die. If he just wasn't here, life would be great. And if you catch that, yeah, if he wasn't here, life would be great. And when you catch it and sort of replay it slowly and clearly, if only she wasn't this way and she was that way, I would be happy. You can't get to the end of the sentence before you find yourself cracking up. It's like it's a joke. And it's not a joke because the thinking mind has said, oh, that's foolish. But it, from your own intuitive wisdom, your heart recognizes, oh yeah, right, of course, you just get upset by something else, or there'd be another place that would seem more perfect, or another thing to get desirous of, or if you did get that thing that you want, then yeah, you know that in 10 minutes you'd want something else. So that way of catching the judgment, inflating it, if only I had this, if I was the abbot of Amaravati, then I would run this place really properly. I mean, because I can't think that, because I don't get to play with that one. But the rest of you can. Yeah, if I was the head of this place, I would. And catch it, replay it, and then watch what happens in the heart. So you just see how it falls apart on its own. And you're not reasoning, you're not thinking your way to a kind of dismissing of it, but it just falls apart on its own. It's like a leaf falling off the tree in autumn. It loses its life, it loses its strength, it just falls to pieces on its own. And if you carry this out, like, if you were different, I would be happy. And you find this sort of stupid grin coming over your face, because you're in your heart, you know, it's not that way. there'll be something else to get annoyed about. And that kind of seeing of the absurdity of it, laughing at your own mind, that's, again, a very powerfully liberating quality, because it's revealing that that judgment is can only be partial. It's got a bias to it. It's just one particular perspective. It's like an emotionally charged reaction. So I do this a lot, and I find this is incredibly potent sort of practice. But again, it does depend on to develop this to have the mind as quiet as possible, to notice those judgments, and then to consciously, deliberately sort of replay the words the mind has said, and like w if you've heard Lumpo Sumedho giving talks about this or in his books, there's a when you replay the thought to overemphasize it, to kind of spell it out super clearly, like, if you were different, I would be happy. So that you're in a way clarifying, making clear the absurdity of it, and then just watch it fall apart. And then when it's fallen apart, just see what is the experience of the world. One of the retreats I was leading in Thailand, the one with Ajahn Kongrat, Ajahn Piyasilo, one particular person on this retreat is a gentleman who's got quite a high position in society. And I was surprised that he'd signed up for this retreat, because he's someone who doesn't really put himself very often in a position of sort of vulnerability, or being within a very contained environment like that, keeping noble silence, following a routine. I was surprised that he'd signed up for this 10-day retreat. And I was teaching this kind of approach, this sort of practice. And he is someone who, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying, is generally very sure of his own opinions and judgments, and is kind of clear about how things should be, and what's right about the world and what's wrong about the world. And it was very touching, because he spoke up and he said, I started to do this practice, like inflating my judgments, as you were saying. And I thought, why is that going to help? Or what's this for? But I started to do that, and then after I began that, there was this realization of what an idiot I am. What a fool, what a complete fool I am. He said, and I started crying. He said, it wasn't just like a couple of tears. It's like I would cried for a whole day, and many tears. This both for the kind of recognition of the foolishness of his mind, but also the sense of relief. I was really impressed by that he would also have the humility to share that. So I'm not guaranteeing any kind of great breakthroughs, but I do recommend this as a way of getting perspective, changing the attitude towards thought. So it's not just a matter of deflating it and questioning it and seeing the empty nature of it, but also using this way of inflating it just to reveal the absurdity of our judgments. Desires, things that you want. If I could just have this, if I could just be with this person, if I could just have this thing, if I could just have that particular room or that particular kuti, if I could just be in that place. Or to get rid of things, if I just didn't have this obsession, if I could just get rid of that problem then. Or if you're annoyed with somebody, if I could just get away from that person, if only I didn't have to work with him, everything would be great. Whatever it might be, we each of us know our own, the landscape of our own worlds. And to see what the habits are, and to take the time in the meditation to notice those desires, fears, aversions, opinions, that kind of, or if your mind is very conceited, like you're very sure of your own rightness, to question that, to inflate that, and then to let yourself have a good laugh at how ridiculous the mind is. And this is one of the ways that Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Sumedho have, say, bequeathed to us. They've passed on this. One of the best ways of freeing the heart is through seeing the absurdity, the kind of humor, the ridiculous nature of our minds. And that when we want to get a perspective on thinking, on the world of thought, to really free the heart from that, just being able to laugh at our own thinking habits, just to see how ridiculous they are, the things that we love, the things that we hate, our own rightness, our kind of readiness to take an opinion and defend it, and what a joke that is. How important we seem to be. I was also reminded, I've often shared this story of when I was, many years ago, I lived up at Harnham Monastery in Northumberland, and I'd been there for a couple of years, and I was I was about to come here to Amravati. This was in the summer of 1985, and there was a number of families and supporters around Harnham that they wanted to see me and say goodbye as I was taking off. And this one family, the only time I could get to visit them to say farewell, it also happened to be the day of the birthday party of their 5-year-old daughter. So they said, "Well, Tan Amaro, we really love to see you, but the only day it's really going to work is actually our daughter's 5th birthday party. So are you all right with coming to a 5-year-old's birthday party? Can monks come to those kind of things?" And I said, "Well, I won't be able to have any jelly, but I'm happy to sit there in the corner. But, I won't be joining in any of the games, because that's not kind of going to put too much of a damper on things. I'm happy to be there." So anyway, cut a long story short, there I was, Buddhist monk, sitting in the corner of this house full of four and five and 6-year-olds running about having their party games. And I realize now that this particular person is probably in their 40s, but there was this one young lad who was about 4 or 5 years old, and he looked a bit like Mussolini. He had this sort of kind of Il Duce look, kind of very tidy haircut, very tightly, sort of tidily combed hair. And he was walking around like a little kind of dictator, and he was just saying, "I'm in charge, I'm in charge, I'm in charge." And everybody was ignoring him. All the other kids are kind of running around playing with their balloons and kind of face paint and doing their kind of kids' party things. And this one little lad, he was just, and he was quite serious. He wasn't like being ironic. He was just, he really felt he was in charge. And he was sort of the commander of this party, and everyone should be following him. And no one was paying any attention to him. And I was sort of sitting in the corner watching him say, I'm in charge, I'm in charge. And it was this like a kind of a beautiful illustration of the ego incarnate, kind of Sakaya Ditti in human flesh. So maybe he's here, actually. He's grown up and started coming to Buddhist monasteries. I apologize if I'm making fun of you in public, but it was a very powerful symbol that there's this sort of thing that struts around in our mind that says, I'm in charge. I know what's going on here. I understand life perfectly. I know what's right. I know what's wrong. I'm in charge. Yeah, and I've got the whole thing covered here. But yet, nature and the rest of the human family and the other factors of the mind are ignoring that completely. That in us, which can be so sort of pompous and self-righteous and sure of itself, it's like that little child sort of being a sort of a pocket-sized dictator. It's you don't have to suppress it, you don't have to push it away, you don't have to tell it to shut up, you don't have to react against it, but just say, "Oh, look at that! Isn't that ridiculous? What the mind does, how this can be," and so then seeing it in perspective, seeing those sort of ego-centered judgments of like, "I approve," or "I disapprove," like, so, and that in this way there's a perspective, there's a change of attitude towards thought, and when the attitude changes, and the mind isn't lost in its judgments and its opinions, its loves and hates, then there's enough space for our thinking to be used very effectively, so that then the capacity to think, to reflect wisely, has room to maneuver. There's space in the heart, in the mind. And so then skillful thought, wise reflection, the skillful consideration can operate more freely. It's not so tangled up and confused by self-centered reaction and opinion and emotion, but rather that quality of yoni soma manasikara, wise reflection, can operate. And when we use thought in a skillful way with the tone of wise reflection, yoni soma manasikara or Dhamma Vijaya, the investigation of reality, it has a completely different tone to it. People often ask, what's the difference between thinking and the chattering mind and wise reflection? So when the mind is using thought in a skillful way, then you find the mind thinks in whole sentences that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there's space between thoughts. Like, so you think, you bring up the mind, so how does this work? What's the relationship between feeling and craving? Pause. Well, feeling is always there. That's a natural condition because of the senses. Pause. Craving is what happens when the mind absorbs into a feeling and gets lost in it. Pause. So, don't need to go on, but that is an example of wise reflection, is that there's clarity, there's a measured quality to it, there's a stability, there's a use of conceptual thought, of verbal thought, to clarify the picture of what's being looked at, what's being considered, but the mind is not getting lost in the content. There's a thought takes shape, there's a space, there's a weighing up, a considering of the implications of that, a feeling it out, then another set of words arises, takes shape, to crystallize the next layer of understanding. A wise reflection then has a whole different tone to it. It's not filled with self-view, it's not colored by that. There's a coherent, integrated quality to it. There's a spacious, measured quality to it. And the mind can use wise reflection and be aware of the space of the mind at the same time. So that, again, that ability to know a thought and not to be lost in it, that's an essential part of wise reflection. So there's the space of the mind, and then the reflective thought appears within that. It doesn't fill the mind, there's still the space of the mind present. But that thought is there, and then the way the thought is formed crystallizes a particular quality of understanding. And then also it can be that with wise reflection, what can be understood is that, this much is known, and the rest of this area is unknown. You know that you don't know. And the mind is, when there's wise reflection, it's happy to leave the unknown as unknown. It doesn't have to fill up the unknown with a fear or a hope or a belief or an opinion. Say, oh, well, this much I understand, but this is unclear. I don't know what that's about. Okay. So that wise reflection, it knows its own boundaries. It knows its own limits and doesn't have to, it's not afraid or averse to the unknown. It knows the unknown and is not diminished or threatened by that. So these are a few thoughts on thinking to reflect upon for the evening, for consideration.